This information is designed to provide accurate and authoritative information with regard to the subject matter covered. It is offered with the understanding that the presenters are not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If legal advice or other expert advice is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.
Welcome to the Aurora Real Estate Investing and Real Estate Financial Planning Podcast. Learn all about investing in real estate in Aurora, Colorado, with a combination of real estate financial planning and modeling with numbers specific to Aurora, plus syndicated, more generalized recordings of live and pre-recorded real estate investing classes. Not all of them specific to Aurora. Be sure to stay tuned after the podcast for a message from our sponsors.
Well, good morning and welcome, everyone. I am your host, James Orr, and this is another episode about warning, danger, the risks of investing in real estate. This is, I think this is the third one in our series so far, and this one is about the risks of rental property expenses increasing when investing in real estate. And so I'm going to jump right into it. We got a lot of stuff to cover and some relatively new ideas. I mean, I've discussed some of these ideas before, but I will talk about them in a new way today, I think. And you're definitely going to want to watch the previous class I did where I talked about some of these ideas before, the rent resiliency and the price resiliency stuff that I talked about in that class. So I'll reference that and I'll put it in the show notes for you guys as well. All right, so here's a quote. The time to take counsel of your fears is before you make an important battle decision. That's the time to listen to every fear you can imagine. When you have collected all the facts and fears and made your decision, turn off all your fears and go ahead. And that's General George S. Patton. So what are your fears related to investing in real estate? And I think one of the fears people have, it may not be their top fear, but one of the fears that people have is that they're going to buy a property and the expenses on that property are going to get out of control. Their property taxes are going to go up some ridiculous amount. Their insurance is going to go up some ridiculous amount. The HOA is going to get out of control and the prices are going to go up on that. The maintenance on their property is going to spin out of control. The capital expenses on the property are going to spin out of control. Utilities on the property, like all of these expenses we have on buying rental property, I'm going to kind of hold the mortgage one as kind of its own little deal. We'll talk about that, I'm sure, in another class. But like all these other expenses that people have fears about, especially at least right now, as the time of recording this, I'm recording this on June 1st, 2023, and we've seen, I don't know, what is probably arguably an unprecedented period of time where prices have gone up so rapidly in the last several years, and, you know, interest rates have gone up and rents have gone up, but not quite as much to keep up with the prices and the interest rates. But one of the things we're seeing now is the aftermath of all those price increases. In a lot of states and counties, we're seeing property taxes go up because the property values have increased so much. And now the taxes are catching up because taxes are usually calculated in arrears in a lot of places. And so we're seeing this massive increase in property taxes. And I think it's scaring a lot of people because their property taxes are going up by, I don't know, in some cases, 50%, which is really hard for you to adjust to if you weren't expecting that. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. So the risks of rental property expenses, we're going to use property taxes as sort of a single representative example of all the other expenses that you could have. I mean, we can go and talk about, like, you know, what happens if the HOA expense goes up and stuff like that. But, you know, if we talk about property taxes and how we will address, you know, the issues associated with an expense like property taxes or like HOA or like maintenance or whatever it is increasing, I think you'll get the idea of how we're going to deal with this and how we're going to address it. I'm not going to cover each one in excruciating detail. In some cases, I'll mention some things that might be a little bit different. But what we're going to ask ourselves is, how do we avoid the risk of rental property expenses increasing like this? And then we're going to discuss, what do we do if this happens? You know, we're in a time where this is probably really appropriate for a lot of folks who are facing this massive increase in property taxes. And we're going to talk about what that means and what do we do when this happens to us, which it's happening to a lot of us right now. And I'm going to discuss some options, but I'm not necessarily going to put them in the best order because I don't know if there is a optimal or best order. I think part of it depends on what your end goal is, what you're trying to accomplish, and what your unique situation is. Because I may choose the best solution for me is to actually sell that particular property and find another property where the economics of that property are a little bit better. Or I may decide that, you know, keeping that property and doing some finance changes or changing the strategy I'm using or whatever things we're going to discuss here as possible solutions, I may choose that that is a better option for me because my end goal is different than someone who selling a property is not the ideal. Okay, so it really depends on what your unique situation is. All right, so this is a chart I made. It's a chart I made a long time ago, and it's still appropriate today. Maybe the percentages have changed a little bit, and they will change a little bit over time. I think that's what we're really discussing is how certain expenses can change as a percentage. And in certain markets and in certain types of financing, these expenses will definitely change. But what this represents, it's a visual pie chart showing you all the different expenses on a typical rental property. And I'm trying to show you how large the expenses are compared to another. So if we look at this chart, we can see that this large gray area is what the mortgage payment is. And you can see that that takes up, I'm just eyeballing it here, but you know, it takes up about 2/3 of the expenses on the property. You know, there's property taxes and insurance and HOA and utilities and maintenance and vacancy and property management. And we're showing all those other expenses as well on here. But if we look at this, the mortgage payment in this particular example property takes up about 2/3 of all the expenses on the property. Now, if you don't have a mortgage on the property, obviously you're not going to have that expense. If you have a mortgage where you only borrowed a very small amount, that's going to take up a much smaller percentage. If you have a mortgage payment that is much higher, you know, than a lot of this other stuff, like if you borrowed a lot of money, like 100%, for example, in order to finance a property, then your percentage of your mortgage may take up more. And in some markets, property taxes will be a larger percentage. In some markets, insurance will be a larger percentage. But just the overall idea is that these are relatively accurate sizes showing you the just relative proportions of someone who is buying or investing property with, you know, a decent down payment and they have these other expenses on it. Now, because the mortgage payment is such a large percentage, typically what we want to try to do is try to lock in that mortgage payment. It is, in most cases, by far the biggest expense that most investors are going to have on their rental properties. And so we want to try to get that to be fixed. That way, over time, as taxes go up, insurance goes up, the HOA goes up, utilities, if you're paying any of those on your rental property, goes up, any maintenance you've got in your property goes up, the vacancy goes up, property management goes up. Like, as all of those increase, the mortgage payment one will actually end up getting smaller because that becomes fixed. When you get a 30-year fixed rate financing loan, the mortgage payment is the same. It's the same payment in month one as it is in month 120, as it is in month 240, as it is in month 360. So usually the mortgage payment is going to remain fixed. Now, if you decide to do something a little bit more outside of the conservative stuff that I usually talk about, like getting a variable interest rate loan, you will likely have your mortgage payments adjusting on you over time. And so in those cases, your mortgage payment would not be fixed and it would be risky for you. So if you went and got an adjustable rate mortgage, an ARM, or you went and got a, you know, a commercial loan on a property where you had, you know, fixed for the first 5 years and then it's, you know, adjusts on you and then it's fixed for another 5 years, then adjusts on you and then it's fixed for another 5 years. And then after that, you've got a balloon where you've got to pay the whole thing off. That is not what we're talking about here. And those things, that would be an additional risk that you're voluntarily taking on by deciding to do these adjustable rate mortgages or some type of commercial rate loan that has a balloon or something like that on there. Okay, so as the other payments go up, they still represent a small overall part of the expenses. So even though property taxes might increase by 50%, you can see it's still not a massive amount of the overall expenses on the property. This mortgage payment is still going to be very, very large if that happens. Okay, now what I'm going to do next is I'm going to remove the mortgage payment and I'm going to show you now in a different pie chart using the same exact expenses, but I'm going to show you that we remove the mortgage payment. Now, what percentage of these expenses do property taxes take up as an example, or insurance take up, or maintenance, or utilities, or HOA, or whatever it is? And so we can see on here now, once we remove the mortgage payment, what the size, the relative sizes of these might be on a property in your marketplace. And again, these can vary. So in some markets, your property taxes are going to be a much larger percentage. In other ones, insurance are going to be much larger. In some cases, if you've got really expensive utilities on a property, that might be a significant one, or maintenance on an older property, or maintenance might be less on the newer property. Like, all of these things matter and they can come into play, but I'm just trying to give you a relative idea of the sizes. And so you could see in this case, because we've removed the mortgage payment, now we can see the relative sizes of all the other rental property expenses, excluding the mortgage payment. And you could see that in this case, for example, property taxes are about one quarter, or about a little bit more than 25%, looking at this visually, of the expenses on the property, okay? That just gives you an idea of what you're looking at and like which ones are. So you might say to yourself, okay, looking at this, if I'm concerned about, you know, where my risk is in doing this, if you've got one that takes up a very large percentage, for example, maintenance, then having maintenance change could have an abnormally large impact on your rental property expenses. For example, a 50% increase in maintenance is a much bigger part of the pool than if we saw a 50% increase in an HOA expense. So if HOA went from $100 a month to, you know, $150 a month, a 50% increase, that's not going to be as impactful as seeing maintenance go from whatever this is on here, I don't even know, $300 a month to now $450 a month. Okay, a 50% increase on each of them, but because maintenance is already a larger percentage, it's going to have a larger impact. It's going to be a bigger factor in what happens to your cash flow on your rental properties. All right. I wanted to show you, I did some studies on this before, my local marketplace. I wanted to show you historically how property taxes are related to the actual price of homes. And so I went back and I looked at whatever this was from when I did it. I had data going back to, looks like 1997 through 2016 when I did this. And I wanted to show that while the amount, the percentage of property taxes as a percent of the price of the property does change a little bit over time, and there's a range of like where they are. So like this shows you the bottom end of the range, and this shows you the top end of the range, shows you the spectrum of like how these things vary. I did want to show you that while it does change a little bit year to year, overall, it's relatively stable. So if you think about this, are property taxes always going to be a specific percentage of what the actual sold price for property is? And the answer is no. However, it doesn't vary like dramatically where it's like half one year, and that they're seeing this little range of values for all this stuff. And that's all I want to point out to you. The only thing you need to take away from this slide is in most markets, and there's probably exceptions to this, but in most markets, the percentage of property taxes compared to the actual sold price of a property when it actually sells is usually going to be around a relatively consistent range. It's possible in one year, it's a little bit more, it's a little bit less, especially if a property is appreciating faster than the taxes are, or the assessor is thinking that that property is changing value at, or it's doing slowly. You know, like those things can have an impact on this. But I wanted to point out that for the most part, we're seeing this kind of like relatively static line for the relationship between what property taxes are and sold prices. All right, so let's talk about how a change in the underlying expenses on a property impacts cash flow. And what I want to point out here is that a 10% expense increase does not mean a 10% decrease in cash flow. And for a lot of you, you're like, yeah, that's obvious, James. That makes a lot of sense to me. But for someone who is brand new in the real estate investing world, that may not be obvious to them. That if property taxes go up by 10%, oh, that just means that my cash flow is going to be 10% worse. No, that is not what it means. It can be much more than 10%. A 10% increase in your property taxes could be a reduction of your cash flow down to zero, or it can be much, much less. A 10% increase in your property taxes could mean, you know, only a 1% change in your cash flow. So for example, I want to give you just like an extreme example to see like how this works. So if your cash flow was $1,000 per month and your taxes went up 50%, from $200 per month to now they're $300 per month, which for a lot of folks in our current marketplace, that may actually happen. You know, if they're doing an assessment and they're seeing this massive increase in property values, maybe your taxes are going up quite a bit. Cash flow would go down by approximately 10%. So a increase of 50% on taxes, 50% on taxes from $200 a month to $300 a month means that we've increased the expense on our taxes by $100. But our cash flow was $1,000 a month. Now, after you have an additional $100 a month in expenses, now it's $900. So cash flow would go down by approximately 10%. I'm using really rough numbers. It actually doesn't change exactly like this, but I want to give you a simplified example so you can follow along how it's working, okay? Now, if your cash flow was only $100 a month, if you had a highly leveraged property, if you recently bought this and you put a relatively small amount down, you know, just enough so that you've got just enough positive cash flow, that's $100 a month, and your taxes went up from that 50% from $200 per month to $300 a month, the same 50% increase that we did in the previous example, now you have a $100 more expense on your property taxes. Well, cash flow would actually go down by the full 100%, or the $100 a month that you were getting in cash flow is now zero. Because your expenses went up by $100 and you only had $100 in cash flow. So a 50% change resulted in a 100% decrease in cash flow. And that's what I want to point out to you, is that these changes can have amplified effects or muted effects depending on usually your leverage in your property is really what it comes down to, and how much cash flow you might have compared to what the increase in the expense was. Okay? That's what I want to point out to you about that. So I mentioned at the beginning that there is a class that you should probably go rewatch. So we've talked about this concept of rent resiliency. I think the class was called Rent Resiliency and Price Resiliency for Real Estate Investors. And in that class, I talked about this concept of resiliency. Resiliency is defined, this is not the real estate specific definition, this is the more general one, but resiliency is defined as the capacity to recover quickly from difficultness or toughness. So how tough is something? How resilient is something? Another definition is the ability of a substance or object to spring back into shape, elasticity. How quickly it can recover, like how damaging is something, is kind of like what resiliency is talking about. So when we've talked about rent resiliency in the previous classes, but the same concept, which rent resiliency was, how much can rents go down before I have negative cash flow? How much can my rents drop on my rental property before I would have negative cash flow on it? It is a measure of how resilient you are to a change in rental conditions. Rents don't always go up. Sometimes rents go down. Sometimes markets soften, sometimes the economics change, and sometimes you can no longer get the rent you were getting the year before or the tenant before for a property. And that means that rents have gone down. And so how resilient is your property or your portfolio, depending on how you're measuring it, to a drop in rents? That's what we talked about. We talked about this rent resiliency concept, and price resiliency is just how far prices can go down before you'd have negative equity. Okay. So we talked about that previous class. We really focused in on rent resiliency and price resiliency. I walked through a whole bunch of details. You really should go back and watch that class. It's on the podcast. It's really good. It's probably close to a year ago. It's probably close to the beginning. I don't know if it's exactly episode number one. It's probably episode, I don't know, 15 or something like that. I don't even know exactly what number, but I'll put a link to it in the show notes. Okay. Definitely go listen to that podcast and you'll understand this concept more. The point I'm trying to make here is, though, rent resiliency is not specific just to rent. This idea also applies to other things like property taxes. So property taxes resiliency would be, how resilient are you to an increase in property taxes? How much can property taxes go up before you'd have negative cash flow? And we can measure that in either dollars, how many dollars we could see property taxes go up before we'd have negative cash flow, or percent. What percent can property taxes increase before we would have negative cash flow? Okay. Or it could be measured on a specific property. So on this property, how resilient is this property to an increase in property taxes? Or we could look at our entire portfolio. We could say, okay, for my portfolio right now, how resilient am I, or how risky is property taxes when I think about my portfolio? Am I super sensitive to a change in property taxes? And you can think about that. And you can think of it either as a snapshot, like, okay, today, if I look at my portfolio today and I saw a jump in my property taxes by 10% or 50% or whatever it is, how resilient am I to that? Or we could look at it over time and we could say, look, over time, my portfolio becomes much more resilient to property tax increases as rents tend to increase and my expenses tend to be fixed. Okay, so you can look at that either a snapshot in time, or we can look at it over time and we can measure that. In general, the more leveraged you are, the less resilient you are to increasing expenses. And vice versa, or the opposite is true, the less leveraged you are, the more down payment you put up, in other words, the more resilient you are to a change in the underlying expenses on the property. Okay. Now, we've been talking about this idea of property taxes resiliency, but it's not just specific to property tax. Remember at the beginning, I mentioned we're just talking about this as sort of like a placeholder for all expenses. So it's really not just property taxes resiliency. This could also be vacancy resiliency. How resilient is my portfolio to vacancy? If I saw a bump up in vacancy, if vacancy went from 3% to 6% a year, am I going to have negative cash flow? Or how much does my vacancy need to go up to before I have negative cash flow? Is actually a measure of that. Or property insurance. How resilient am I to changes in property insurance? If all of a sudden insurance companies realize that there have been a lot of risks on those properties, like we see a area become prone to fires or high winds or flooding or whatever it is that maybe wasn't quite there before, and now insurance doubles because they're having to pay out a lot of claims and your property just happens to be in an area where that is a higher risk sort of thing, then maybe your property insurance will increase and you have to think about how resilient are you to a increase in property insurance. Or maintenance resiliency. You know, as your property gets older, what tends to happen, it's not universally true, but what tends to happen is the maintenance on properties tends to increase. And so as you get an older property, maintenance increases. And so how resilient are you to changes in your maintenance number? If you were using a 8% or 10% or 12% or 15% or 20% maintenance number, and that changed, it went, you know, up 50%, then what does that mean for you? How has that impacted you? HOA resiliency is similar. You know, what if the HOA changes? Sometimes HOAs decide to do special assessments and they significantly increase their homeowners association fees to cover things like, hey, we didn't realize that we were going to have to replace all the siding on all of the buildings in the complex, or we're going to have to redo all the parking lots, or we just decided to acquire this city park, which was neglected, and now the HOA is going to take it over. And so our HOA fees are going to go from $300 a month to $600 a month. You know, if you weren't expecting that, that could be problematic. And so how resilient are you to an HOA resilient? How resilient are you to a change in HOA fees? Or utilities. If you're paying the utilities on a property and you've got, you know, leaks on the property or something else going on, then you might experience some shocking utility fees. Yeah. We've seen that happen before. You know, you have an apartment building that has a massive leak somewhere and your utilities are usually, I don't know, whatever it is, $1,000 a month. And now they jump up to $5,000 in a month. Or capital expenses, you know, your capital improvements you need to make the properties. How resilient are you to those? Or property management fees, property management resiliency. So all of these are other types of resiliencies we have that are not just property taxes. And the idea applies to them as well. So for example, maintenance, how much can maintenance go up before you'd have negative cash flow? That would be a measure of maintenance resiliency. Okay, but this applies to all these other ones, vacancy resiliency, property insurance, HOA, utilities, capital expenses, property management, as well as that property taxes one. All right, so what are the options if property taxes get too high? And I think this does apply in a lot of cases to the other ones as well. So first of all, how do we avoid it? Well, how do you avoid property taxes going up? I think one way to do it, and it's probably one of the few things that you could do, is you could vote. You know, you can also try to contest them if you want to, which we'll, you know, kind of talk about, but you know, really, it's like, how do you avoid them going up overall? It's vote for things that are going to keep your property taxes low. Okay. So when your property taxes get too high, if you find yourself in a market where you're like, whoa, you know, this used to be a sort of break-even cash flow property that I acquired. Now it's really negative, and I'm not sure I can either handle the negative or I desire to handle the negative. Then one option would be to sell the property. You could decide to sell. Or another option could be you could hold on and absorb the difference. You could say, okay, now the property taxes are up. I can eat this negative $300 a month if it went negative on you and decide to hold that. And you can look at and model out in the future, you know, how long it might take before you get to the point where it's break even again. You could use like the world's greatest real estate deal analysis spreadsheet. You could change, you put in there in the overrides tab what your new property taxes are. And now you could see what the new cumulative negative cash flow number is and how long that will last for. How long you will need to pay that negative number before it's likely, based on your assumptions when you're doing your modeling in the spreadsheet, like when that negative cash flow will go away. So you decide to absorb the difference and look at your overall return and see if this investment still makes sense to you. Okay. Another thing you could do is you could decide to change how you're structuring your leases. You could break out the lease payments and start renting it out more like a triple net lease and show the taxes and say, look, you know, and this is much more common in commercial property than it is in residential properties where you're doing this. And it might be very difficult for you to do this on a residential property if you've got just like a single family home. But in some markets, commercial properties especially, you will see that the landlord, the owner of the property, is the real estate investor, is going to rent the property, and they're going to separate out what the rent is, but then they're going to tell the tenant that they are responsible for the taxes, the insurance on the property, and all the maintenance on the property. And so it is a triple net lease for them, where they are collecting a certain amount of rent, but the tenant in the property is responsible for taxes, insurance, and the maintenance on the property in that particular example. Okay. And so you could change the structure of how you're doing this. Now, how do you do this practically as a like more residential single family home, duplex, triplex, fourplex type of investment? Well, one variation of this is you offer it to a tenant buyer where you are selling the property to them, or convert it straight up to owner financing where you are agreeing to finance the purchase price of the property and you're collecting a fee for doing that, you know, your payment on the property. And then as an owner financing person, they are usually responsible for the taxes and the insurance and the maintenance on the property. And so the like variation, the version of how to do this with residential properties is actually to convert it to like some type of owner financing situation. Or think of it more like a tenant buyer on like a rent to own, where you explain to them, look, you know, the rent on this property would normally be this, but you know, because you're actually going to be buying the property, then we really want to make sure that you can afford to pay the property. So the payment on this, if you were to buy it, looks more like this would be the payment. Plus you'd have taxes, plus you'd have insurance. And you could sort of increase what the expenses are on the property by showing them what it would cost them as an owner doing that. And you could talk to them how the payment's going to closer reflect their ownership payment rather than a straight up rent payment when they're doing that. And you could adjust the other terms, of the deal in order to make that work. Okay. So what else can we do? What other options do we have when property taxes get too high? Well, number one, we can contest the taxes. We're seeing a lot of that right now where people are saying, hey, 50% increase. That's a lot we're seeing on these properties. So maybe I want to go find comparables and contest those with the county assessor to say, look, we don't believe that the valuation you have on our property is this. The tricky part is, you know, you're wanting to see property appreciation. It's one of the things that you were happy about when we saw the property values go up. You're like, this is great. You know, I bought this property for whatever, $300,000. Now it's worth, you know, $450,000. This is amazing. I just saw, you know, my investment of $60,000, I put 20% down, let's say, now is worth, you know, $60,000 plus a little debt pay down plus another $150,000. Now it's worth, you know, $220,000, $230,000, $240,000. And you're like, this is amazing. I quadrupled my money, or I tripled my money, right? And you're thinking about that and you're like, this is awesome. Well, now it's time to pay the piper because property taxes went up because you had that thing. Like, you know, a lot of people say, you know, appreciation is one of these things where you don't have to pay on it until you sell the property. It's like a sort of like hidden gain in the property that you don't do it on. Well, that's not exactly true, right? Because one of the things we're seeing when we see appreciation in properties, massive appreciation, is we're starting to pay taxes on that gain in the form of property taxes. We're paying the new taxes on the new higher dollar amount. And so we are paying for that gain that we have a little bit in advance of actually even realizing, unless we're doing some type of cash out refi or selling the property, okay? So you could test the taxes as a way to deal with property taxes getting too high. Or you could decide to bring in a partner to help offset that additional expense. Say, look, I will give you whatever it is, negotiate, you know, 10%, 15%, 20%, 30%, 50%, 75%, 0%, 1%, I don't know, whatever you decide to negotiate with your partner, bring them in and have them offset some of the expenses. You're collecting a fee from the partner to buy into the deal, another way of thinking about it, and they are covering this added expense, for example, property taxes going up, in exchange for some piece of the deal, either a piece now or a piece of the future equity and debt pay down part of the return, okay? So that's what we do, options with property tax or not. Let's talk a little bit about insurance. It's very similar in a lot of ways, but there might be a couple extra things in here. So how do you avoid it? Well, number one way to avoid insurance getting too high is buy properties with better insurance characteristics. And they do vary a little bit. So there are certain properties where the insurance is going to be higher than others, and select those. Select based on not just, hey, I want to maximize for, you know, my rent to price ratio, or I want to buy a property because I can get in with nothing down. Maybe you think a little bit more about this, take a more holistic approach and look at the overall investment rather than just optimizing for one parameter that may not serve you well in the long term. Okay. So one way to avoid insurance getting too high is buy properties with better insurance characteristics and maybe some other things. So let's talk about what happens though when insurance gets high. You can do the same thing. You can sell the property. Insurance gets out of control. You're like, okay, can't buy this, can't own this property anymore. It used to be close to break even. It used to be $100 with positive cash flow. Now it's negative $300. I don't want that property anymore. After you evaluate it and see, look, you know, the overall return is still not acceptable to me. I want to get out. So you can sell it. You can hold on to absorb the difference. We talked about that before. You hold on and you look at how much negative cash flow you're going to have and what the overall return looks like and whether it does serve your end goal. And you can make a decision based on that. Or we talked about this solution before. Break out that lease and to be more like a triple net lease to show that the insurance is a separate increased payment on that. Again, offer the property to a tenant buyer or convert it to owner financing where you pass on the insurance cost to the tenant or the buyer in that case. Or these are some of the ones that are a little bit different. Find a new insurance provider. You can't go find a new county to assess your taxes. But because insurance is sort of like a third-party thing, you could, in many cases, go and shop around and find a different insurance provider that could provide you with either a lower cost policy, or you could voluntarily choose, it's kind of the next one here, you could choose to change the terms of your insurance and get either a higher deductible where you take on more of the risk yourself. You're choosing to actually, if there is a claim, you're going to pay out more of that claim than what the insurance companies pay. So that would reduce your overall premium, the monthly payment you're making or the yearly payment you're making on the insurance, or get different coverage. So, you know, before I was getting coverage for all these extra things in my property. I am choosing not to get that coverage anymore. I will personally take on that risk if I have a problem with the property. And so you can choose to get different coverage where less things are covered and you can reduce your payment that way. Okay. So those are some of the options for when insurance gets too high. What about options when the principal and interest part of your mortgage payment change? Not everybody decides to get a 30-year fixed rate mortgage or a 15-year fixed rate mortgage or a 40-year fixed rate mortgage, if you can get your hands on one of those, or 20-year, whatever. There's lots of ones, but a fixed rate, fixed payment mortgage without a balloon at the end. This is so the option when principal and interest change is usually only when you have a variable rate loan of some type, where the loan can change, the payment can change on you. So how do you avoid that? Well, don't get an adjustable rate mortgage to start with. That's how you can avoid getting it. You can avoid having your mortgage payments become variable by deciding to never get a variable rate mortgage. So that is one option. I think there's a lot of folks, especially right now, when people think, you know, interest rates are up so high, I'm going to get this, like, you know, 5-1 ARM, and I'll, you know, when rates go back down, I'll go ahead and refi out. Well, rates may not go back down and you may end up with an adjustable rate mortgage and rates may still be up there around, you know, 7%, 8%, 9%, 10%, who knows? Maybe even a lot higher at that point. You don't know. So be careful with those adjustable rate mortgages. So how do you avoid having your principal and interest change on you? Don't do adjustable rate mortgages. So what do you do if you find out that it happened to you? You can hold on and absorb the difference. We've kind of talked about before. You could sell, and you could sell using a traditional sale. Or you could use that kind of like lease option sale where you get out of the property and you're dealing with the consequences for a short period of time, a year or two or three or four or five, while you're waiting for the tenant buyer to actually go and get qualified, get to the point where they can actually get a loan and purchase the property from you. Another option is maybe consider paying off the loan. You know, restructure your portfolio and actually pay off the loan itself. Maybe you decide to, you know, pull cash out of other properties or take cash you've got sitting on the sideline or got sitting in some other type of investment that is no longer performing the way you want it to, or it's no longer serving you in the way that you hoped it would serve you and your kind of like goal to get to financial independence. And you take that money and you use it to pay off the mortgage, because now the mortgage is actually a better return for that money than what you were getting elsewhere. So pay off the mortgage or refinance out. Say, oh yeah, okay, I thought I was going to do this ARM thing, but now I decide I'm going to do fixed rate. And you go ahead and do that. But the challenge is, in a lot of cases, when these payments adjust, if they adjust up, it's because the interest rate environment has gotten worse than when you first got the loan. And so you may be getting penalized for refinancing at that point. So you got to really be careful about that. It's not like the situation where we see when we do these fixed rate financing loans, where you buy a property and you have this fixed rate loan, and if things get better, you can always choose to then do a refinance, rate and term refinance, or cash out refinance, and actually change the terms of the loan and improve on your cash flow. You know, that's one of the things we have the advantage of when we get these 30-year fixed rate loans. And then if interest rates improve while we have them, then we could always do better, but we're never going to get worse than where we are. When we do these ARMs, it can get worse. And then if things get much worse, we may be forced in a lot of ways to kind of say, okay, now I learned my lesson. I don't want this thing to continue to adjust on me next year or 5 years from now when it goes adjust again. I want to get out of this. I want to lock it in now. And so then you kind of get penalized. Where before, you never really get forced. Your hand never gets forced. You can improve on it if rates go down, but you don't get like this penalty when rates go up. That's when you do the fixed rate financing versus doing the variable ones. Or as we discussed before, maybe bring in a partner to deal with this. Either they cover the difference or they refinance you out or do something like that. But you could bring in a partner to help solve this problem if need be. Okay, so those are some of the options when you have a change in principal and interest, like your mortgage payment on a property. What about when interest rates rise? Well, there's two parts. How it affects your payment, which if you're getting these fixed rate mortgages, it shouldn't. If you're getting a variable rate loan, adjustable rate mortgage, then it can. And that's, you know, partly don't do those. And then how it affects real estate values and rents and stuff around you. And in fact, that probably will. And we are seeing some of that now, although we're in a really weird market because interest rates have gone up pretty dramatically in the last year and a half or so. And we haven't seen in every single market, we've seen some markets a little softening and some price declines, but we haven't quite seen the significant declines that a lot of people might have predicted for such a drastic increase in property values. And part of that is because we had this Goldilocks period of people being able to lock in these really low fixed rate financing, and they sort of feel like, hey, I'm not going to sell my property now because I'm not going to be able to replace this 3% or 2.5% or 3.5% loan that I've got. If I go try to buy something else now, it's going to be at 7. Okay. And so a lot of folks are not selling, which is keeping inventory down. And because inventory is really low, it's keeping prices artificially up. I don't know if it's artificially, but it's keeping prices up. Okay. And so normally, if we saw this massive rise in interest rates, we might see prices start to soften or decline, and we might see rents to soften or decline in some cases. And so how do you avoid this? So those are the two parts, by the way. So how it affects your payment, which it shouldn't if you get fixed rate financing, and how it affects real estate values around you, and it probably will. And we are seeing some of that, but not quite the same way that we might see it in what a lot of folks would consider to be a more normal market. I think this is an unusual market, right? We have these very unusual forces going on. And so that's what's happening there. So how do you avoid interest rate rises? Well, I mean, not much you could do. You could send $5 to the Federal Reserve chairman each week with a gentle reminder that you'd love to see rates remain lower, and see what they do. I mean, but I can't really do anything to manipulate the interest rates personally. We could try to do things in our own personal universe to make them relatively lower. You know, if rates are 7% for the general public, we could choose to spend some money in order to buy our rate down. Or we could do things like, you know, get creative in our financing and decide to buy property subject to the existing financing, where you go take over existing loans, or we do loan assumptions or some other type of creative solution to take advantage of lower interest rates that we saw in the recent past. But as far as like avoiding rates going up, not a lot we could do. So if you find yourself in a situation where the market has changed and because interest rates have kind of gone up and we see a influx of more properties on the market and them lowering rents to be competitive to get their properties filled because there's vacancy, you may have to lower your rent if you need to compete. And you might need to hold on and absorb that lower income when interest rates rise. Okay. You can also change the use. For example, you can convert the property to a rent to own or owner financing or wrap financing and, you know, almost use the increased interest rates to your advantage. Maybe you locked in at 6% or 7%, and now rates are at 8% or 9%. Well, by changing the use of your property where you were using it as a rental, if it no longer makes sense for you to keep it as a rental because the economics have changed a little bit, maybe converting it to a rent to own or owner financing where you're offering someone financing, if rates are now at 8 or 9%, maybe you offer them something at 8.5% or something like that. And now your interest rate's at 7%, you're offering them financing at 8.5%. So you're getting a interest rate spread on the amount of money that they're paying you based on what you're seeing in the property. You could literally sell it for the exact same price that you bought it for. And because your interest rate spread is there, you could actually make money on that. You'd have to make sure you protect yourself so that they don't pay you off early, but that could be a solution for you. Or just outright sell the property. If the economics no longer serve you and your goal, consider selling. Or if things got really, really ugly, you know, if this became end of the world sort of severity, you could decide to give the property back. You could deed in lieu of foreclosure. If like interest rates rising causes all real estate values to go down 50% and you could no longer sell and pay out the difference because if you sell for a loss, you got to come out with the difference there. You could say, look, I no longer want the property. I'm going to either have a foreclosure or you could deed the property back to the lender and say, look, I'm going to give you the deed back. I no longer want the property. You can have it. So that's like worst case end of the world in that situation. All right. All right. So in conclusion, I think we had a good discussion on the risks of these kind of like property expenses increasing and what we can sort of do about them and some of the possible solutions there. So life has risk. Real estate investing, we choose to do that, has some additional risks that we're voluntarily taking on in exchange for the returns that we're expecting by investing in real estate. Now, there are some expenses that are within your limited control. There are things we can do to manipulate some of the expenses. You know, for example, on maintenance, we can try to minimize our maintenance costs by spending a little bit more in order to do things a little bit nicer that are going to be needed to replace a little bit less frequently. And we could sort of reduce our maintenance costs as an example doing that. Or we could choose to self-insure a little bit more and take on some additional risk by having a lower insurance premium. So are things that are within our limited control. And there are some expenses that are outside our control. You know, I would say property taxes being an example of things that are mostly outside your control. There's little things we could do, but for the most part, the assessor's going to assess and they're going to charge you property taxes. And if property values as a whole go up, your property taxes are probably going up. Okay. Now, you can still take action based on what happens. We have solutions if these things occur and we can do things about them. We can sell properties. We can change the characteristics of how we're renting them, how we're utilizing them, or what the strategy we're using. Like all those things that we discussed as things that we could possibly do, those all apply. So that's all I got. Hope you all enjoyed the class on warning, danger, the risks of rental property expenses when investing in real estate. This has been James Orr. Have a great day, everybody. Bye-bye for now.
With home prices up, mortgage interest rates up, and rents up, but not quite enough to counteract the higher prices and interest rates, cash flow on rental properties in Aurora is harder than ever. Book a call with the Real Estate Financial Planner to apply our proprietary 88 strategies to improve cash flow on your rentals. See the show notes for a link to schedule your call and improve your cash flow today.
If you're a real estate agent, lender, or professional in Aurora that wants to help our real estate investor listeners, consider reaching out to learn about collaboration opportunities with this podcast. We'd love to add more value to our listeners by having you assist our investors buy, sell, and finance their real estate investments. See the show notes to schedule a call to discuss collaboration opportunities.